Richard Martin's Wake Up Call Podcast, presented every Monday and Friday, providing you with the truth and the facts. You decide.
Good day to you all, ladies and gentlemen. This is Richard Martin from the Wake Up Call, coming to you from Malaysia on Friday, the 15th of January, 2016. So first of all, on the donation front, I regret to have to inform you that donations are simply still not materializing to any significant degree. I have had several well-meaning offers of advice, which usually mean me doing something. But you know, I am a simple person by nature, and when I see a clear picture in front of me, I tend to find it hard to push it out of the way. Here's the deal. I prepare and record the bi-weekly shows. You, my dear and faithful listeners, donate. How much more complicated than that can it possibly get? As things are right now, it looks like we may have to go subscription-based at the end of the month, which will, of course, include all those who have been generous enough to donate already. Your donations will simply become subscriptions. Now, I am really hoping this will not happen, and I am going to need considerably more support between now and then to avoid it. So please, ladies and gentlemen, do your best in the next few days. As I pointed out in the write-up that accompanies this show, we have less than 5% of the listeners donating as of Wednesday evening, your time. To say I am perplexed by this would be an understatement. I am stunned. Anyway, on to the show. So if you're not watching it purely for the entertainment value, sitting through a State of the Union speech ranks somewhere between a colonoscopy and a root canal. The absurdity starts almost immediately. The sergeant-at-arms introduces the President of the United States, and he receives a massive 5-minute standing ovation as he walks across the water to the podium. The applause finally dies down briefly, until immediately afterwards the Speaker of the House formally introduces the President. And then the applause begins anew. Try explaining that to a foreigner who's never seen it before. Foreigner, why is everyone clapping again for the president, as if they weren't just clapping for him for 5 minutes 30 seconds ago? Me, because that's just the way they do it. Foreigner, but why? Me, because they're all trained monkeys? But it is at this point that the real propaganda begins, where the President of the United States tells his fellow Americans that they are prosperous and free. He cited, for example, the 14 million jobs created since he took office. Of course, he failed to mention the more than $8 trillion in debt. That's a 77% increase that has been accumulated since he was inaugurated 7 years ago. If the president truly wants to take credit as the job creator in chief, the basic math works out to be nearly $600,000 in government debt for every single job created. While debt in the US has increased 77% over the last 7 years, GDP has only increased by 13%. Now, you'd think that for each additional dollar the US government was spending and indebting future generations, there would be at least $1 in GDP growth. Ideally, you'd get more than $1 in GDP growth. Duh! Businesses have to do this every single day. If I borrow $10 million to buy and develop agricultural farmland, obviously the net effect, once I'm finished, should result in a property that's worth more than $10 million. But that's not how it works when government spends money. It took them $3.71 of debt to buy just $1 of GDP growth. Yes, the overall result may show that the economy is technically bigger than it was in 2009, but this ratio is completely screwed up, and it is not indicative of, quote-unquote, the strongest, most durable economy in the world. In the meantime, there have never been more pages of laws, rules, and regulations ever in the history of the United States than there are today. January the 15th, 2016. Just yesterday morning, in fact, the federal government published another 369 pages of regulations. Today, there will be even more. Should you find yourself out of compliance with any of them, the government can summarily deprive you of your freedom, your property, and even your family. And it can do so administratively, without a fair and speedy trial in front of an impartial judge and a jury of your peers. This is not what freedom and prosperity are all about. President Obama is undeniably upbeat about America. And he's right. There are a lot of amazing people doing great things in the US. There are many wonderful things about the US. It's clean, modern, reasonably safe. The standard of living is very high. But decades of insane regulation, government debt, and astonishingly destructive monetary policy have resulted in a society where it is now easier to consume than produce. Prosperity is not complicated. People figured out thousands of years ago that if you wanted to do well, you had to produce more than you consumed. But the American system is the exact opposite, favoring those who recklessly borrow and spend, rather than those who work hard and responsibly save. The President of the United States boldly accused everyone who doesn't share his view as just making things up. In his words, quote unquote, "Anyone claiming that America's economy is in decline is peddling fiction." This is an extraordinary and delusional statement. The government's own numbers show that they are completely insolvent, to the tune of nearly $19 trillion. The annual reports for the Social Security Trust funds show that they are rapidly running out of money. The Federal Reserve's own balance sheet shows that it is precariously undercapitalized, with net capital less than 1% of total assets. The Census Bureau's data shows that the earnings for middle-class Americans are stagnating. The Labor Department's numbers show that the number of Americans who have dropped out of the workforce hasn't been at this level since the Carter administration. USDA figures show that the number of food stamps recipients is near an all-time high, simultaneously when the number of homeless children in America is at a record high. And all of this at a time when trust in government is near an all-time low. These are all facts, not fiction. The only fiction is pretending that this story has a happy ending. anyone claiming that America's economy is in disguise, lying, is peddling fiction. Ladies and gentlemen, your president is a stupid man. And you're about to elect another. Obviously, the talk of the day is the stock market, and I shall not shrink to rise to the occasion. Here's something I have never seen in my entire career in this business. The representative of one of Wall Street's most prestigious houses is predicting a 75% drop in the stock market. Albert Edwards, representing the major French bank Société Générale, suggested that stocks would soon fall from what he calls their obscene levels. As Edwards admits, most believe a 75% equity bear market to be impossible. Yet he predicts that the S&P 500 gauge of US stocks could fall to 550 from its recent 2,100 peak. His views put him starkly at odds with the Wall Street consensus. As he says, quote unquote, "I realize most people think I am talking utter garbage, but I'm used to that. The bear market of 2009 was not complicated," Mr. Edwards said, arguing that it would take further economic downturns for equities to come down, quote unquote. "That obviously will be a catastrophe for the economy via the wealth effect, and all the Fed's QE hard work will turn to dust." Edwards believes that this coming collapse would result in, quote unquote, "a trade war not unlike that in the 1930s. Mirroring the deflationary bust and trade war of the Great Depression era. His calls are, of course, out of sync with mainstream economists who believe that US GDP will rise by 2.6% this year. Quote unquote, "I believe the Fed and its promiscuous fraternity of central banks have created the conditions for another debacle every bit as large as the 2008 global financial crisis." Albert Edwards has been the one person from the mainstream who for the past decade has firmly held the belief that a deflationary ice age is upon the world, courtesy of an unmanageable debt load, no matter what central banks do. There is, of course, one way to short-circuit said ice age, and it involves para-dropping money in an act of terminal fiat desperation — the outcome is always hyperinflation — onto the general population, something which is already in the works, courtesy of first Eder Turner and the IMF, and soon all other very serious people. Keep an eye on Japan, as this is where said para-dropping will be attempted first, as Ben Bernanke suggested back in 2003, when he said to, quote-unquote, "Consider, for example, a tax cut for households and businesses that is explicitly coupled with incremental Bank of Japan purchases of government debt so that the tax cut is in effect financed by money creation." But before we get there, here is a snapshot of where, according to Edwards, we are now and why there is getting very close. He says, quite simply, that it is now too late to put what he calls the orc-like monster of excess debt and declining cash flows back in the bottle, and why, quote-unquote, "the global economy will be thrown into chaos." The deeply held wish of central bankers not to derail the fragile economic recovery is on display for all to see, as they grasp at the slightest excuse for their continued reaction or inaction. The UK's central bank governor, Mark Carney, exceeded all dovish expectations recently in his latest rate flip-floppery. But what is this? the Fed has finally summoned up courage and raised rates. It is, however, already too late. Having delayed way beyond the point when it might typically have raised rates in previous cycles, it has allowed an orc-like monster to incubate, hatch, and emerge into the sunlight, snarling and ready to do battle. Free Fed money has led to an unprecedented corporate credit binge of excess spending, especially on share buybacks. This is even bigger than it was at the time of the 2000 technology and telecom bubble. The rotten fruit of the Fed's seemingly innocuous inaction will now be clear to onlookers as it ripped to shreds on the battlefield by the powerful credit monster. The global economy will be thrown into chaos. Edwards points out that while corporate debt has finally been appreciated, it is not the debt itself that is the risk. It is the decline in EBITDA, or cash flows. Edwards also points out that when it comes to real wages, the Fed is already behind the ball. Another reason why higher nominal wage inflation has been slow to appear, despite the tight labour market, is that it didn't need to. Real wage inflation has been very robust indeed, as headline CPI inflation has collapsed to zero in the aftermath of last June's oil price slump. So wages have definitely responded, as normal, to the tight labour market. The biggest threat, then, is for corporate margins, which have already declined by 60 basis points this cycle and fast dropping even lower. Certainly, history suggests that wage inflation cycles are a major influence in the Fed's thinking on interest rates. But even without much of a rise in wage inflation over the past year, the deeper we go into this cycle, the more unit labour costs rise because productivity growth becomes more feeble. This is a very important concept for you to understand, ladies and gentlemen. Productivity rose by only 0.4% year on year in the third quarter of 2015 versus 1.4% in the third quarter in 2014, which when combined with a 2.4% rise in compensation, the same as last year, means that unit labour costs rose 2% year on year in the third quarter of 2015 versus 1.1% the previous year. So even without rising wage inflation, profit margins are squeezed by rising unit labour cost inflation. But what is squeezing margins even tighter is the evaporating pricing power. With corporate output price inflation slowing sharply to 0.8% year on year from 1.8% 1 year ago. With company revenues also declining, this margin squeeze fatally undermines corporate profits and is central to my conviction that the US economy will be driven back into recession. And in a typical recession where corporate profits fall sharply, what the corporate sector does not want is too much debt. Oh dear, too late. When corporate margins have dropped by 60 basis points, as they have already this cycle, on 5 out of 6 prior historical occasions, this has resulted in a recession. This time won't be any different. The Fed raising rates just as both the global and US economy are slamming the brake on growth and going into reverse will result in something far more dire than what was experienced in 2008. The orc-like monster is indeed ready to come out and play. So the carnage has just begun. Lucidus Capital Partners, an investment manager specializing in corporate credit, recently announced it was liquidating its entire portfolio and returning $900 million to clients next month. Third Avenue rattled markets when it announced on December the 9th that it was liquidating a $788.5 million corporate debt mutual fund and delaying distribution of investor cash to avoid even bigger losses. And Stone Lion Capital Partners has also halted cash redemptions for its investors. But as usual, the Wall Street cheerleaders quickly provided a myriad of excuses for these individual failures and eagerly offered reasons why this isn't systemic. They claim Third Avenue focused on high, ultra-high-risk illiquid assets that didn't belong on a mutual fund platform. And the Lucidus had one large investor who wanted his money back. Or that apart from energy, these junk bond funds are, wait for it, rock solid. Yeah, but you see, within the Third Avenue focused credit fund, 78% of the top 10 holdings weren't energy related at all. This is eerily reminiscent of similar assurances given at the onset of the subprime fund failures back in 2008. As the Bear Stearns High Grade Structured Credit Fund and the Bear Stearns High Grade Structured Credit Enhanced Leveraged Fund brought down the legendary investment bank that bears its name, most pundits were confident that these particular funds represented isolated cases. Those same Wall Street apologists were busy pontificating that the failure of Bear Stearns was due to a mismanagement issue and not a part of a larger problem in the mortgage market, and certainly had nothing to do with a systemic problem in financial institutions or the global economy. In the same way, this time, the issue is not limited to just a small subsection of high-yield junk. Remember those CLOs, collateralized loan obligations, that almost brought down the entire economy in 2008? Well, they're back, and they are now being issued at a record pace. Yield-hungry institutional managers and retail investors have been lured into these debt securities that are collateralized by loan pools consisting of highly illiquid bank loans. What's even worse, leveraged bank loans outstanding have been the engine of the recent financial engineering of M&A and stock buybacks, and they amount to nearly $900 billion, up 80% from the post-crisis bottom. Remember how investors in search of a higher yield coveted the mortgages of unqualified homeowners leading up to the Great Recession? Well, today they've turned their pursuit to low-credit corporate debt and the leveraged loans of distressed borrowers. In 2007, the entire mortgage market was worth $10.7 trillion, $4.6 trillion of which was composed of subprime and Alt-A loans. Currently, the high-yield debt market is worth more than 55% of that amount today. However, just like the carnage in the subprime mortgage market was not at all contained, the entire credit market spectrum from junk to sovereign debt is now in a bubble. And because prices have been artificially manipulated by the Fed for so long, all bond yields will eventually spike, either due to inflation and/or insolvency. For 7 years, the American economy, and especially its stock market, have grown off the back of asset bubbles and artificially suppressed interest rates. As these misallocations of capital are revealed, Janet Yellen and Company will realise that the fragile economy cannot withstand the pressures of interest rate normalisation. Therefore, she will be compelled to take back her quarter point rate hike in an act that I'm sure Wall Street will categorise as mortified courage. Perhaps the most important takeaway from the Great Recession was that the blow-up in subprime eventually exposed the bubble in real estate and the banking system as a whole. And as the market begins to see the forest behind the high-yield trees, it will realise that after 7 years of zero interest rate policy and quantitative easing, the true bubble exists in the entire universe of fixed income.
Share the truth. Invite others to listen to Richard Martin's Wake-Up Call. Richard Martin produces his shows single-handedly, based on his extensive reading and research. Every week, Richard gives you the facts with no spin, for you to make informed decisions on world events that will affect your life. Now, let's get back to today's show.
According to the 2014 census, 14.5% of Americans, or over 45 million people, live in poverty, up from 11.3% in 2000. Of the five Republican debates and of the three Democratic debates, not one moderator has asked a question involving the words poverty or poor. The topic has been entirely unmentioned by the moderators during the three Democratic debates. In the GOP debates, the candidates only bring up the topic as a way to swipe President Obama, which is fair enough, but there is never any discussion of poverty, much less a good faith attempt to mitigate it. By comparison, the Democratic debate moderators brought up ISIS, or terrorism, 21 times total in all three debates. A recent study in The Intercept found poverty's non-status on television isn't just limited to the debates. Cable news was over 20 times more likely to mention ISIS or terrorism than poverty during the heart of the primary season in late 2014. The poverty rate remains stubbornly immovable. To exacerbate the problem, an increasingly cruel GOP Congress has slashed billions from the government food stamp program and ended unemployment benefits. Poverty is particularly bad for single mothers. One third of families led by single mothers lived below the poverty line in 2013, or 15.6 million Americans. One recent study has linked poverty to diminished IQ in children. It impacts childhood education, crime, and even future economic gains. A 2011 study attributed 133,000 deaths a year to poverty-related illnesses. Islamic terrorism, by contrast, which they all love to talk about because it's a vote catcher, has less of a chance of killing someone than bee stings or furniture. Only 45 Americans have been killed since 9/11 as a result of Al-Qaeda or ISIS-inspired attacks. So why has not a single debate moderator mentioned poverty? Those working for votes like Sanders and, to a lesser extent, Clinton, have proposals for it, but not one of the hundreds of debate questions has been on the issue of poverty. Aside from the fact that the class interests of those who run the media and work in it are overwhelmingly wealthy, if not overtly anti-poor, the topic has no doubt been bumped even lower on the priority list due to recent ISIS fears. as The Intercept notes, in the wake of the Paris attacks on terrorism and ISIS, are 2,344% more likely to get mentioned on CNN than poverty. Bringing up the issue of poverty to the debate's sizable audience isn't superficial. A 2012 study by Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting found that cable news mentions of key topics like inequality were inextricably linked to their coverage of Occupy Wall Street. The national conversation follows political dialogue, and priority is given to those issues highlighted by the political class. It took over a year of sustained protest and direction action by Black Lives Matter to get major candidates to discuss racism and criminal justice reform. Without a similar effort to draw attention to poverty, it's unlikely that poverty will ever register a blip on the corporate media's radar, much less be of a primary concern. There's very little poor Americans can take away from the exchange beyond platitudes. When it comes to the economy, candidates often talk in abstractions like job creators, growth, and the nebulous middle class. But poverty is a clear and quantifiable metric for a civilized society. Poverty is objective, measurable, and its rates among Americans, specifically American children, is a manifest, clear as day national scourge. One would think if debate moderators have time to ask about fantasy football and who a candidate's favorite enemy is, they could squeeze in just one question specifically addressing the needs of those living below the poverty line and how the candidates plan on ameliorating the suffering of 45 million people. Just another reason why you need to get out of the country fast. These people are heartless fools. They will never help you if you fall on hard times. You need to be in an environment where people understand poverty and hardship. You will be amazed at the degree of warmth and genuine generosity they will extend to you if you fall on hard times. Well, clearly, any rational individual is much better off simply holding physical cash, rather than keeping substantial funds in a savings account these days, with interest rates headed towards the negative state, i.e. where you pay the bank for the privilege of them holding your cash. This situation has happened already in several European countries, and there is a high likelihood that it will come to America as well. So, in keeping with my theme of the year, it makes no sense to keep cash in the bank. Cash may not pay any interest, but it doesn't cost any either. It's a pretty sad statement when the 0% you earn from holding physical cash is considered high yield. Of course, governments know this. They realize that no rational person is going to want to keep money in a bank, especially as negative interest rates cascade into consumer banking. And that's a huge reason why there's such a push to outlaw cash. The banking system would collapse. There simply isn't enough physical cash in the system. Plus, most banks are so highly leveraged, and they lack the liquidity to honor any meaningful amount of withdrawal requests. This is one of the fundamental dangers of negative interest rates. Central bankers, in an absurd, desperate attempt to generate inflation, are accomplishing nothing more than destroying the banking system. And even when it doesn't work, even when the numbers prove that their ridiculous goal of increasing inflation isn't working, they just keep trying the same thing over and over and over and over again, making interest rates even more negative. It's madness. These people have broken the concept of money. Money is one of the most important social technologies in the history of the world, almost as important as language. Money is supposed to mean something. It's supposed to be the metric by which we measure economic value. But they've destroyed that. And it's so obvious now. But cutting the price of money or interest rates so far into negative territory, money has become so worthless that even a government doesn't want it. And in doing so, they have created the most absurd problems imaginable. It's pretty clear that this is not a risk-free environment. And the worst thing is that there's no single solution to protect yourself from the consequences of this madness. Holding physical cash is the best option to hedge short-term risks in the banking system. But with so many politicians and idiotic economists calling for a ban on cash, you may not have as much time as you think. Ladies and gentlemen, you've got to start thinking in this direction. Look at the obvious risks and determine what makes sense for your situation. Most people will unfortunately succumb to the default option, doing nothing and assuming that it's all going to be okay. Because the smart guys in government will figure it out. But this is pretty dangerous thinking. You won't be worse off for taking sensible steps to protect yourself from undeniable risks. But should any serious consequences ever arise from this financial madness, they'll happen very quickly, and it will be too late to do anything about it. And at that time, looking back, it will all seem so obvious. I suggest you get moving. So, here's something I found in the latest edition of International Living, which I thought of interest. An article by Dan Prescher, one of their most prolific writers, entitled, "Are You Courting Disaster by Moving Overseas?" It describes an aspect of moving abroad that I have never addressed, so I thought I'd use this opportunity to do so. Here goes. I have friends back in the US who still think I'm courting disaster living outside the country, even though I've been safely and happily doing so for 15 years now. "Aren't you afraid of being killed or kidnapped?" they ask, as if every place outside the United States is a war zone or a lawless Wild West backwater. These friends, who still think I'm crazy for living outside civilization, usually fall into two groups. The first group includes those who have never lived outside the United States and, in many cases, never outside their hometowns. Their viewpoint of the rest of the world comes via television, movies, and the internet. Naturally, they see the rest of the world, with the possible exception of any city featured in the last few James Bond movies, as one big, crumbling, explosive Third World War zone or ghetto. The second group includes those of my friends who have spent some time abroad but have done so in the military or on religious or governmental service missions. These folks have often actually been sent to crumbling, explosive Third World War zones, Third World War zones or ghettos. So these are naturally the places they commonly think of when they think of someone living outside the US. Not surprisingly, The same misconceptions my US friends have about the rest of the world are shared by my local friends abroad about the US. Not that they spend a lot of time thinking about the US, but when they do, they see it in terms of the latest news cycle, just like everyone else in the world. And what they see is, to them, a lawless Wild West backwater where everyone carries a gun and shootouts and mass murders are a daily occurrence. From a statistical point of view, this too is a misconception. The actual intentional murder rate in the US is fairly low, according to the latest data from the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime, UNODC. The UNODC list ranks countries by the number of intentional homicides per 100,000 people, and the US ranked 98th among the 218 countries where data was available. Not the best, but not the worst. Why am I dwelling on all these murder rates and news cycles and misconceptions? Just to make the point that despite what we're shown on TV, in the movies, and on the internet, most of the world is pretty much the same. With the exception of a few notable hotspots that garner all the media attention, most of the world is made up of peaceful, pleasant places where people are living normal lives in the context of their culture and geography, including the US and the many countries I've lived in and worked from for the past 15 years. This is a point I'd like to get across both to my US friends and the local friends I have abroad. The world outside the US isn't one big thief-ridden third world ghetto or exploding war zone. And the US isn't one big lawless gun-toting Wild West shootout. In reality, the world abounds with safe, comfortable, friendly places to live. Every year, International Living publishes a long list of them, and the input for this list comes in great part from the first-hand experience of people actually living and working in those places. I, and most other expats I know, don't live outside the US because we're crazy and like to court danger, or because we're afraid to live in the US. We live outside the US precisely because there are so many safe places where the weather is better, the scenery is more impressive, and the cost of living is cheaper than the places we lived in back home. And the local people are friendly and welcoming. And also because it's a huge adventure to live in and experience another culture and to see your own through new eyes. And if you could have a huge adventure, save money, have fun, and do it safely, why wouldn't you? Well, as you can see, Dan works for International Living. His brief, or his bailiwick, isn't the danger of living in the United States. It's simply the pleasure of living in another country. And the fact that he's lived overseas for 15 years bears testimony to that particular statement. What I do here on the Wake Up Call is put much more emphasis on the future danger of living in the United States. Dan probably doesn't know anything about these things. He doesn't follow them, he doesn't read about them, and he doesn't know about them. But, ladies and gentlemen, I am here to give you a very different kind of perspective about what it takes to live in the United States today and what it will take to live there in 10 or 20 years' time. And as you know, my view is not very sanguine. So, with all due respect to Dan Prescher, I feel that you should be looking in a different direction and with a very different viewpoint indeed from the pleasures of simple life abroad. You need to get out of Dodge fast. Okay, well, I have a note from Steve Kruger, one of very few. I don't know what's happened to Steve over these past few months. He has not been his usual prolific self, but nevertheless, I get this from him, and so it goes. Richard, to to avoid being sold out by politicians and bankers in the tradition of the Greek confiscation of the public's savings in banks. I need to ask you if we have any banking safe haven. I was thinking like a Scott trade account that must be segregated by law and pays no interest. Or are we the people being set up to directly bail out the banks? Roosevelt did the great gold switcheroo, grabbing it at $20 an ounce and then putting a $35 per ounce price on gold. That's around a 65% hit. Then Nixon opened the floodgates by pulling the gold backing from the dollar that turned the dollar into a 100% instrument of debt. We don't actually have any money in circulation, just debt. So I guess what I'm actually asking is, if in the end, is your mattress the only way to keep your Federal Reserve notes safe? Steve Kruger. Well, Steve, as I've said, you really can put the money into United States Treasury bills, courtesy of Treasury Direct. Many people have done this and have had excellent results. You won't make any money, but you won't lose any money. And if at any time in the future it seems to me that for some reason the entire federal government is likely to renege on everything, including its shortest term paper, I will let you know in time and we can think of the next move. But right now, as I've said, keep approximately 3 months or 3 to 6 months in liquidity, either under the mattress or in your bank if you need to pay bills with it, and keep the rest in Treasury bills on a rollover basis, I may add, which simply means ticking the box, which allows the government to roll over your Treasury bills every 180 days when they become due without you having to give permission or take any steps. Have you noticed whether, if you speak to any number of so-called educated people, you recognize that their thinking is nothing but cliché or snippets from what somebody else has told them to think? It is extremely rare to encounter someone who has actually done any primary thinking. Show me any modern thinker who even holds a candle to Goethe or Steiner or Leibniz. Our institutions of higher learning are in reality thought control organizations. Despite advertising to the contrary, the collective intellect of the human race has declined significantly from the 19th century. Am I wrong? Just look at the prose used in letters by Abraham Lincoln during the Civil War and compare that with our jive-talking presidents of today. Where are dignity and honor to be found today? When was the last time anyone has seen a person make a stand based on the principle involved? The ends do not justify the means. The law should apply equally from the poorest to the richest, most well-connected. That's what the rule of law is all about. That's what principles are all about. Have a look at the latest presidential hopefuls and observe their behavior. Which ones would actually qualify as principled individuals? And which ones could you actually count on to act in a principled manner? And which ones believe that the ends always justify the means? Just that test alone is enough to make you weep for the future of humanity and the United States in particular. Well, as a British expat who has spent most of his life living on the continent, as we Brits are fond of calling the non-British part of Europe as well as the United States, it might seem rather odd to be encouraging my fellow Brits to vote to leave the European Union. I never believed that the interests of Britain would be best served if the country was a fully fledged member, not only of the European Union, but of the Eurozone. I think I can safely say that I've been proven right over the events of the last few years. By the time the sovereign debt crisis hit Europe in 2010, the full extent of the European Union's ambitions was clear. Slowly, almost imperceptibly, to weaken nation-state institutions to the point of total dependence on Brussels, and then have them supplanted with European Union institutions. It is the financial equivalent of death by a thousand cuts. The EU's weapon of choice was the single currency. Luckily for Britain, its government hadn't joined the euro. The Chancellor of the Exchequer at the turn of the century, Gordon Brown, knew that sacrificing the pound would have been electoral suicide, which is the only reason he did it. Preserving the national currency has provided the UK with some measure of economic independence and flexibility. There are, in fact, many similarities between the creation of the United States of America and what they're trying to do in Europe. As in Europe, the American colonies were assured that they could opt out of the Union at any time, a promise which proved excruciatingly hollow, as we all know. For many European countries other than the UK, their economic independence and flexibility died the day they joined the euro. As Spain's economy minister Luis de Guindos recently put it, quote unquote, "The Eurozone is a club where you can check in, but you cannot check out." The main reason for this is that the euro is merely a means to a much more coveted end. Political union, as Germany's finance minister glibly admitted in a 2011 interview with Welt am Sonntag. Quote, "We decided to arrive at a political union via an economic and currency union. We had the hope, and we still have it today, that the euro will gradually bring about political union. But we're not there yet, and that's one of the reasons why the markets are so distrustful." End of quote. When asked by Welt am Sonntag, "So will the markets now force us into a political union?" Schäuble replied, quote, "Most member states are not yet fully prepared to accept the necessary constraints on national sovereignty. But trust me, the problem can be solved." End of quote. As Schäuble promised, the constraints on national sovereignty in Europe have been severely tightened since 2011. European Banking Union became a reality last year, transferring supervisory authority over the banking systems of the Eurozone's 19 economies to the ECB, an institution with even less transparency and accountability than the European Commission. Now the European Union is planning to use a brand new crisis to expand its powers, Europe's refugee crisis. As the Financial Times reported last week, Brussels is set to propose the creation of a standing European border force that could take control of the bloc's external frontiers, even if a government objected. If the plan is approved by European Union states, Frontex's replacement will have a slew of new powers, including the ability to hire and control its own border guards and buy its own equipment. It will also be allowed to operate in non-EU countries, such as Serbia and Macedonia, which have become transit countries for people trying to reach Northern Europe, if requested. The new agency will be able to deport people who do not have the right to remain in Europe, a power Frontex lacked. Even the pro-EU Financial Times merely concedes, quote unquote, "The move would arguably represent the biggest transfer of sovereignty since the creation of the single currency." After all, controlling one's own borders is one of the core functions of a sovereign state. Naturally, country being piloted in new schemes is Greece, which is on the front of Europe's refugee crisis. Once those agents from countries like Germany and Poland have been dispatched there, the project will no doubt be swiftly extended to all other EU states. Even non-EU countries such as Serbia and Macedonia could soon fall under the EU's protective umbrella, but only if requested. Thanks to their opt-outs of EU migration policy, Britain and Ireland will not be obliged to take part in the scheme. For now. Back in Britain, the UK's embattled Prime Minister David Cameron is desperately trying to convince recalcitrant British voters and Eurosceptics in his own party that he is on their side. According to official accounts, he has been busy flexing his diplomatic muscles in Brussels in a last-ditch effort to deliver fundamental reform to Britain's relationship with the EU. As City AM's Brian Monteith warns, however, it's all an elaborate ruse, a highly choreographed EU dance. It is a bittersweet fudge designed to fool the public into believing there will be worthwhile reform of the EU when the evidence of the EU's Five Presidents' report demonstrates that it will only get more centralised, more expensive, and more regulated. In the coming months, all manner of doom and gloom scenarios will be paraded to cajole British voters into voting the right way. Almost all of Britain's elite institutions, including, of course, the City of London Corporation, want Britain to remain in the EU. Even the US, Britain's closest ally, recently got in on the act, warning London that if it leaves the European Union, it would, quote-unquote, be subject to the same tariffs and other trade-related measures as China or Brazil or India. However, most Brits don't seem to be buying it, just as a majority of Danes were able to drown out the establishment's fear-mongering before voting against forging closer ties with Brussels in a recent referendum. In the latest poll of British voter intentions, 52% of respondents said they would vote to leave the EU, up from 27% in June. Granted, polls can be deceptive. No one knows better than David Cameron himself, who in May this year rankled Brussels by winning re-election on a manifesto of reform and referendum. However, trying to deliver meaningful reform in the UK's relationship with the EU is an almost impossible task, especially given that what Cameron claims to want, a little less EU interference in British affairs, is completely at odds with what the Eurocrats in Brussels want, ever increasing EU interference in everyone's affairs. Since joining the common market in 1975, the people of Britain have been repeatedly told by Europhile politicians in Westminster and Eurocrats in Brussels that the European project represents no threat whatsoever to British sovereignty or democracy. By now, such claims have lost all credence. At this critical juncture of European history, it bears remembering that the EU is not Europe, and Europe is not the EU. The EU is a primarily political project run by an unelected elite with the so-called five presidents at the helm. As the British blogger John Ward eloquently notes, this elite routinely ignores the individual, ignores state sovereignty, ignores debt mountains, ignores currency realities, ignores poverty, ignores its responsibilities, and above all, ignores every legal and constitutional obstacle in its way. At the advent of each new crisis, often a crisis it itself created, it launches a new grab for power. Customs union, monetary union, banking union, defence union, digital union, energy union, fiscal union, political union. There is no limit to Brussels's lust for power and control. In the coming year or two, the people of Britain will have a once-in-a-generation chance to elude its grasp, to preserve its sovereignty. As a British expat, I urge them not to waste it. All right, ladies and gentlemen, I believe that we have come to the end of another show, and I believe that it is time, please, for you to think again seriously about donating if you haven't already done so. And to those that have, please let me offer my sincerest and deepest thanks. I really, really, really do appreciate it. So that's it from me. Have a great weekend. I'll be back on Monday. This is Richard Martin from the Wake Up Call, bidding you au revoir until then. Bye-bye for now.
And there you have it. You decide.